Good morning, all. Welcome to Brookings. I'm Tom Mann, a senior fellow here, and I'm delighted to welcome you in conjunction with my colleague Norm Ornstein of AEI to this event entitled Toward Public Participation in Redistricting. I decided to have a little chat with Hu Jintao on my drive from home this morning. And his 47 escort cars, so that's why I'm a little late. I apologize for that. Anyways, I'm delighted to invite you to the latest kickoff of the redistricting season in American politics. I would like to say at the beginning that first I want to pay tribute to our late colleague Larry Hansen, who was so instrumental in encouraging a number of groups like ours to take a good hard look at the way in which districts are redrawn and to see if there weren't ways of harnessing new technologies and the public to improve a process that we all understand, but frankly leaves us all a bit uneasy and unsettled. I think it's going too far to blame gerrymandering for partisan polarization in America, but there's no doubt that the very partisanship and polarization that exists is perpetuated, is exacerbated by the temptation of parties and politicians to harness the process that is used still in most states to redraw district boundaries after each decennial census. It's a complicated process. Tim Story, one of our participants today, will tomorrow launch for the National Conference of State Legislatures a major workshop on redistricting, and all you have to do is participate in that, look through the extraordinary volume NCSL has put together on election law and to see the sort of complexities of both the law and the process in redistricting. It's not a simple matter. And even majorities in state legislatures working in accord with their own governor face constraints, legal constraints, and just the practical constraints of frankly, working with a particular geographical distribution of citizens as they occur. In some states, you've got to do real gerrymandering to produce, say, more competitive districts. And it's a complicated matter to be sure. Nonetheless, I believe this round of redistricting is the season of a new season of transparency and public participation. It's really quite instructive to see the number of groups that we have, nonprofit groups, major groups that are involved with individual states trying to open this process. And we are particularly proud to have worked with our colleague Michael McDonnell and his associate Michael Altman to facilitate that process by working to produce open source mapping software that will, we hope, empower individual citizens and, more importantly, groups of citizens to provide a little competition for the formal redistricting authorities. We already have some precedent for doing that in individual states that have made particular efforts. Texas is one of those states that really has a quite extraordinary process of transparency. And opportunities for public participation, although it's somewhat ironic, Claire, that also in the news these days is Tom DeLay's conviction and sentencing. for playing that redistricting game with pure political hardball to the point of illegality in the state in the state legislative election that preceded that extra and unusual round of redistricting in Texas that probably did more to galvanize the reform community and the public than any other event. Anyways, it is an opportunity for a new day. We now have seen the apportionment of seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. The census data will be released to the states in not too long a period from now, and a whole elaborate process will begin. Our plan today is to begin, first of all, with an overview. No one could do it better than my friend and colleague Tim Story, who's been working for the National Conference of State Legislatures for many years, has worked closely with their division on elections and campaigns, and spends a good deal of time helping people understand how the redistricting process works. He's going to give us an overview that will provide the backdrop for the new efforts underway. And then we're going to move immediately to Claire Dyer, who's the manager of mapping and redistricting section of the Texas Legislative Council. This is a case where the state government, in effect, creates the resources and sets up the opportunities for public participation. She is going to explain how that works in Texas and then tell us about signs that might be developing in other states that are underway. So that's the overview to begin with. Then we move into if you will, a tutorial on the mapping software. It's an opportunity to describe what the status of the software is, what issues are involved, how one actually makes use of it, the complexities of getting the right data, census and electoral, to be able to pull this off. That is, some people believe that the best way to redistrict is to be blind politically. That is, keep all political considerations out of the process. We've seen in the past that can produce very political partisan outcomes. Ignorance is not always bliss. And so part of the issue is how does one garner and integrate with the software the data that's essential to doing the mapping, and how does one get a handle on drawing maps that are compatible with federal and state requirements and various sort of normative objectives, whether it be protection of community interest, of partisan fairness, of competitiveness. It's a very complex process, and I think we're going to be treated to an explanation of a tool that will be very important in this round. And let me just also make mention of the fact that the Sloan Foundation has really played a critical role in helping to launch this software development effort, and AEI and Brookings have worked together with principal investigators in setting up standards for transparency and public participation, which are included in the packet of material that you have before you. Then our final session will be led by my longtime friend and colleague Norm Ornstein from AEI, who is participating with me in trying to help publicize and advance this effort in this round, and we have four colleagues that coming from different groups who are who will show us what is underway, and I will leave Norm the job of introducing all of them. So that's our plan today. I'm glad to see Jerry Hebert is here from the Campaign Legal Center, who knows as much about redistricting as anyone in this country, and whose organization has worked with dozens of others to try to improve the process by which districts' lines are redrawn. We also have a bunch of pros I see around the room. I'm delighted to have them back in the audience. We've grappled with this subject in the past, and all I can say is I think we've come away since our initial meetings and conferences, and I'm really looking forward to the days, the mornings, presentations and discussions. We're going to begin with two PowerPoint assisted presentations. You know, I was Norman. I have a rule which is never use a PowerPoint because it'll always break down when you're trying to make a presentation. So this is a real test of the system. In any case, Tim and Claire will make initial presentations. Then the three of us will come to the table and have a bit of a chat with you all to the extent we have time. Then just before 10 o'clock, we will move to our second panel. Again, welcome, and thank you for coming. Tim, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate that. Thank you very much. Whoa, that's slick. We're ready to go. Yeah, you're right about using PowerPoint, but let me tell you, I'm not going to kill you with the PowerPoint. I've only got 8 slides, and 2 of them are just, you know, hello and goodbye, so there's really only 6, and 4 of them are pictures. Because when you're talking about redistricting, you got to have some pictures. You got to have some district to think about. I am really honored to be part of this discussion, and I know we're going to try to turn it into a discussion, and I'm looking forward to that. So I am going to be particularly brief in opening this up. In fact, Tom sent me an email, and he asked me to cover a few things, sort of a little bit of a timeline of redistricting and sort of how redistricting is done across the country, constraints on the redistricting authority, and they said you have 8 minutes to do that. And I said, well, you know, we do entire seminars on like one of those things, so you're going to get the 8-minute version of a 2.5-day seminar, and I've already eaten up 90 seconds, so I'm pretty much screwed from here on. Now, I have, as you can imagine, I have been asked to do a number of redistricting overview talks. I can't imagine why, given the timing. You know, the redistricting rolls around every 10 years, as everybody in this room knows. There are a couple of metaphors. Someone says that it's like the refreshing rains that come to the savannah every 10 years. That's how we in the redistricting community like to think of it. Now, other people use a locust metaphor, that the locusts, you know, lay on the ground. They come up every 10 years or 17 years or whatever. I'm going to go with the refreshing rains because I love talking about redistricting. I think I'm one of maybe 9 people that would actually ever utter those exact words, and I suspect that 7 or 8 of them are in the room today. Tom and Jerry and various others. So you'll probably have to get the hook, by the way, to get me down. It's because I do love talking about this. And when I do my redistricting overview talk, I usually try to warm up the crowd with a little game I like to call Guess the District. And I'm going to do a very abbreviated version of Guess the District today. And I have to put a rule on this because I know we have some ringers in the crowd, Jerry, Tom, and various others, and Tom and Norm. So the rule is, if you've ever been faculty for an NCSL meeting, you're not allowed to participate in the Guess the District game, Michael and others. So let's just start. Just sort of holler out. Does anybody know where this district is? Chicago. You know what district? What? Who said that? This is exactly Representative Luis Gutierrez. This is the current congressional district for Chicago. Now this is a see, people always say that. Wow. And this is a. You know, and I'm cherry picking. This is obviously one of the more sort of creatively shaped congressional districts. This is a single district. This is Illinois Congressional District 2. This is actually just the southbound lanes of the Tri-State Tollway on the That's true, right, Jerry? And this is also, I think, the far western boundary of Cook County. This is a predominantly Hispanic district. These are actually cemeteries. There, no one lives here. The although some of them vote. I knew it. Boy, I walked right into that. Chicago and cemeteries and voting. I'm going to use that again, by the way. Thanks. This is a predominantly Latino district, 74.5% Hispanic with 2,000 population data. So this is a Section 2, predominantly a district to comply with Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act for Chicago. This is an African-American district, and this is also African-American district, is that right? So you've got a predominantly Hispanic district and then two African-American districts that border it. All right, who knows this district? This is my favorite in the country. This is a current district. No. Bingo. Give that man a cookie, because this is the second congressional district of Arizona. I love this district because this was drawn by the, the Arizona Independent Redistricting Authority, which held numerous hearings throughout the state of Arizona. If you know much about Arizona geography, this is, I don't think this is Maricopa County, but this is the northwest side of Maricopa County. This is just sort of western Arizona where, you know, a bunch of tumbleweeds and cactus live. Now, this is the Colorado River and the Grand Canyon. This is basically the Grand Canyon right here. And has anybody rafted the Grand Canyon? Yeah. I had the terrific thrill of rafting the Grand Canyon 2 years ago. And at one point in the Grand Canyon, the Colorado River is 54 feet wide. So the cliffs come down where it goes to its narrowest and deepest point of the canyon. And what's beautiful about this district is that if you're on the river, the Colorado River, you're in the second congressional district of Arizona. When you pull to the shore for lunch, you're in the first congressional district of Arizona. So as long as you stay on the water, you're represented by one person. But when you pull to the bank to have lunch, you have a different representative. But the reason for this was, anybody know the reason? Do you know? Exactly. That this is predominantly Hopi territory, and this is predominantly Navajo territory. These are two tribes which have a long-running land dispute going back about 140-some years. And they are, let's just say they don't get along. In fact, there's a great story that had to do with this redistricting plan where one tribe put up a peace totem and the other tribe bulldozed it. And this is absolutely true. So this is a very heated dispute. And so the solution, which was generally agreed upon by all parties involved, especially the Hopi who wanted this map, was to sort of carve out the Hopi and put them into the second district using the Colorado River to connect it. So this is a district that was generally agreed upon by almost everybody in the process, passed muster with the Department of Justice, and is, you know, currently a district for the second district. All right, this one. And whoever gets this quickly gets a prize. No. This is your map, by the way. I ripped this off from Tom Hoffler. I used to have RNC on here, and I took it off. No? Wow, you guys were so good. Rafaela. Who I was going to thank, by the way, for all her help, Rafaela. Rafaela is the proud winner of the 2010 copy of the NCSL Redistricting Grade Book. Can you tell us more about the district, Rafaela?
No.
Oh. Would it help if I did this? Aha! Now, the beauty of this district, by the way, is that it looks so tame by today's standards, obviously. And that's, I think, the point that Tom will make, because he uses this same shtick, and I totally ripped this off with all due respect to Tom Hoffler. But this was actually a state senate district in Massachusetts. It was drawn by Democratic Republicans? In the Massachusetts legislature at the time, in 1812, who were partisans of Elbridge Gerry, who was the governor of Massachusetts at the time. Roughly they drew this district. It elected, I think, five state senators for the Massachusetts State Senate. The best part about this district, and I think this is sort of unconfirmed, but I'm going to take it, is it was drawn by a Massachusetts state senator named Joseph Story. So apparently I was destined 200 years ago to get into this ball game of Elbridge, who wound up on the U.S. Supreme Court. Elbridge Gerry did not fare so well. He was defeated at the election. There's a great story behind this, but I think my 8 minutes are up, and I haven't even gotten to the two slides that have any substance whatsoever. So, Rafaela, you will please pick up your your prize. Usually I give away candy, but today a hard copy of the book. So now I'll get to the hour and a half talk that I have to now put into about 90 seconds. So Tom asked for just sort of a quick status report, kind of frame the rest of the discussion, which is where do we stand with redistricting? Redistricting is coming very soon, is imminent. Everyone knows that the reapportionment data was released actually very early this year, the 22nd of December, I think, somewhere in there. But the redistricting data, which is also known as the PL94-171 data, will begin rolling out from the Census Bureau in the first week of February. So it will roll out to each individual state based on the redistricting timeline for those states. So in the first week of February, I think four or five states will get their data. The second week of February, four or five states will get their data, and so on. And the deadline for the Census Bureau is April 1st. So by April 1st, every state will have their census redistricting data to do the task, to do the process. And actually, probably by the middle of March, I think they're going to be ahead of schedule. I don't think they'll put any out toward the end of March. So we are on the eve of redistricting, which is why I will be gathering with about 350 of my dearest friends out at the Gaylord Hotel in National Harbor to talk about redistricting, because obviously it is sort of keenly on the minds of state legislators around the country. There are 7,382 state legislators in the country, about 6,000 state legislative districts around the country. And redistricting is, despite what you may think, there are a handful of redistricting junkie legislators who love this stuff and are excited, looking forward to it. Most legislators sort of dread this process. I mean, one, it sort of gets layered on top of everything else that's going on, which including massive budget shortfalls that most states are dealing with. So it's not exactly a happy time in state capitals around the country. And then on top of that, you get this sort of extra task that sort of gets layered onto the agenda. And in most cases, and one thing we talked about were sort of the deadlines of redistricting. The big deadline, of course, is the 2012 election. There are four states that have 2011 elections, Mississippi, Louisiana, New Jersey, and Virginia. So they have to have their legislative lines drawn before 2011 elections. But it's not just the election. You got to get lines in place for the primary. And then it's not just the primary. They have to be in place for the filing deadline, because the candidates have to know what district they live in, where they can file. And it's not even just the filing deadline, because you have to give the local officials some amount of time to sort of sync up the precincts with the district. So you've got to give them a little bit of time. And then there are 16 states where all or part of the state is covered by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. And that's in our book. I think it's one of the handouts. So if you're one of these 16 states, you have to either submit your plan to the Department of Justice, your plans, or you could try to get them through the district court for the District of Columbia. No one really does that. A couple states last time, but unlikely. So, and the Department of Justice gets 60 days to review plans, and if they ask for additional information, they can actually get another 60 days. So the smart states will sort of plan on about 120 days off of that filing deadline. So really the deadline is the summer and the fall of 2011. So, and it varies by state. There are a handful of states where they have a state constitutional provision for their deadline that it has to be done in the session following the release of the census data, or the session following the decennial census, like Texas. So there's about 10 states that are in that category. And so their deadlines for redistricting are actually like June the 1st, May the 31st. So about 10 or 12 states have deadlines that are extremely early. So they will be out of the gate and running. And this is important for, I think, some of the discussion that's going to take place here. Because if you really want to sort of be involved in the public participation transparency side of things, it's now, right now. Because the new legislatures have all gone into session. There are five states that aren't in session that they'll be going into session in the next couple of weeks. So all those states where the legislature does redistricting, and by the way, in 43 states, the legislature has the authority to do congressional redistricting. There are seven states with commissions. There are seven states that only have one district. One of those is both a commission state and a one-district state. So there really are 37 states where the legislature has sort of the initial and primary responsibility to enact a congressional redistricting plan. So in those states, the deadlines are now, and the committees that will be drawing those plans are being appointed right now, literally right now. And they're passing criteria and guideline right now. I mean, this week, next week, the next week. So if you're not sort of engaged in your state capital, you're going to miss that opportunity to really have, I think, maybe the most important impact you can have, which is sort of framing some of the criteria that are used to draw the plans, okay? Now, the process does vary greatly by state. We have a saying in NCSL that no two legislatures are alike, and they're all the same, and that's exactly true for redistricting. Everybody sort of does it the same way, sort of at the fundamental base, but they all have sort of individual tweaks and differences among them. And then, like I said, now's the time the committees and the chairs are being appointed. In fact, yesterday, Louisiana adopted their guidelines for redistricting. Illinois just passed a statute about their committee guidelines for redistricting. So this is going on right now. And finally, sort of, Tom asked me to just touch on sort of the political landscape of redistricting. There's little doubt after the 2010 elections, Republicans now control 24 state legislatures, both the House and the Senate. Democrats control 16, and the other 8 are divided between the two parties. That's actually a tad bit misleading because the Nebraska legislature technically runs as nonpartisan, but it's really Republican. Don't tell anybody that I said that. This is going to be on the web. I'm getting in big trouble now. So really 25 Republican legislatures. And the point being is that this is the best position that the GOP has been in the modern era of redistricting. I mean, redistricting really as we know it today did not exist. Even in the 1970s, it's really sort of an 80s, 90s, 2000. This is really sort of the fourth, in my mind, sort of modern version of redistricting as we sort of go through it today. The GOP has sort of unilateral control or authority to draw about 145 U.S. House districts, Democrats about 50, which is a little more than reverse of how it was 20 years ago, and certainly better than it was because the Democrats had that sort of a more dramatic advantage 20 years ago in 1980. And then a little better, or I'm sorry, 1990, and then a little less of an advantage in 2000. However, big word of caution, that doesn't mean that there will be 149, Republican districts just because they will have the majority to control these districts, which is the point that Tom asked me to make, which is that the states are dramatically constrained by a number of different things, not the least of which is the state and federal law. This is NCSL's redistricting law book. This is a summary. This is like the executive summary of redistricting law. And it's a 230, 40 pages long now. So the point being is that just to sort of get your head around the federal law, and this is almost all federal law, that limits and controls and dictates what whoever draws the lines can do, is far more complicated and complex and limiting than I think people care to appreciate sometimes, because it is hard to get your head around. And the other sort of reason is that there will always be, the Republicans will control essentially their process of redistricting in Texas, but there are big pockets of Democratic voters in Texas. So there will be Democratic congressional districts in Texas, districts that lean Republican or lean Democratic. So I just want you to sort of put some caveat around that. I've already talked about the changes. I do want to sort of race through this. There are some big changes for the process in 2011. So this process will be dramatically different. And I'm going to touch on 4 of them and then go into just a tiny bit of depth on the other one and hand it off to Claire. Number one, for the first time, 3 states will reallocate people who are incarcerated to their home of record. Okay, New York, Maryland, and Delaware will be doing essentially an adjustment to the census data before they do redistricting. Now, this is really interesting because there was sort of a big push in the middle of the decade from a couple of groups, and they were successful in these 3 states. And it's sort of the Brandeis laboratories of democracy. These 3 states will try it. It may or may not work, frankly, because the administrative aspect of that is extremely challenging if you ask anybody in these 3 states. So they will be sort of removing the people in prison to their home of record before doing redistricting. Now, it's not unprecedented for states to change their redistricting database or the data file before redistricting. There actually are 2 other states that already did this, Hawaii and Kansas. In Hawaii, they moved non-resident military out of the data, and then in Kansas, they did non-resident military and students were reallocated before they did redistricting. So this is actually a continuation, but this will be a particularly challenging one. California has a new redistricting commission that the voters approved, both for legislative lines and congressional lines. Maybe you'll talk about it later. It's way too complicated to go into. It would make Rube Goldberg proud, this thing. And the question, I think, is will it work? And it might. It's a very fascinating sort of design, trying to sort of govern the politics of redistricting. And I think California was clearly a state that had pushed the limits on what they could do from a partisan perspective. And now they are reaping the windfall, or the from that, reaping the whirlwind of that. I'm going to skip the third bullet. ACS, the American Community Survey, is the Census Bureau's long-form data. It used to be that that was collected in the census and then released about 2 years later. That is not the case. Between 2000 and 2010, the Census Bureau shifted the long-form data collection to an ongoing survey of like 140,000 households a month. Sound right to anybody? Roughly. So so now they will have all of that data. Richard would know that. So they've got all that data, what's called the five-year estimate, at the block group level of geography. So the reason this is important is because there will be this tremendously new detailed set of data that you can use to sort of define communities of interest and sort of analyze redistricting plans. And I'm not sure if that'll be used extensively or not, but it's a wild card. Data software post-redistricting, I think, will be revolutionary to what it was 10 years ago. It'll be much more available. Transparency. There's little doubt in my mind, and I think a lot of this is, frankly, due almost entirely to Michael and the work he's done. I mean, I will give him a tremendous amount of credit here. He has really been pushing this and has helped organize a number of groups and Common Cause and the Midwest Democracy Network, and some of these folks, I think, have been very successful in sort of beating fanning the flames to increase transparency. Now, I happen to think it's probably not as untransparent as maybe people make it out to be. Most legislatures have very extensive sort of open meeting requirements. Agendas have to be filed. There are certainly a few where redistricting is generally done outside and then popped on the floor at the last second and run through. But that's really the exception. Most legislatures will hold hearings, extensive hearings on proposed plans. They will introduce proposed plans. They will vet those. People will have a chance to comment on those. People will have a chance to submit their own plans, either in part or in total. But I think that that's going to go farther than it ever has been. Last time in 2000, half of the states had what are called sort of public access terminals. So they had some sort of way to make give anybody access to draw their own plans. That's going to go way higher, I think, this time. And in a number of states, it's going to be literally online, and then you're going to have online tools like the Public Mapping Project and ESRI putting up the census data and the ability to draw plans through ESRI. So that's going to, I think, be the big game changer for this round of redistricting, and I think it will change how some of the maps look. I've gone over time, Tom. Please forgive me. And appreciate your thing. And we're going to, you know what, I think, you don't want to take questions now, right? We want to go do Claire and then come back. We're going to do that if that's okay. I mean, I will definitely take questions, but I think it's going to go to Claire. And hey, thank you. Let me pull up Claire's. Perfect. There you go. Thanks.
All right, thank you. It's quite an honor to be here today. And see how to work this thing. I'm going to talk about three aspects of how the public can access redistricting and how that's supported in Texas. Okay, I'm not doing very well. Sorry. Okay, thank you. Oh, thanks. All right. That helps. All right. The first is public outreach hearings by legislative committees. We also have redistricting websites maintained by career staff, of which I am one, and ability to draw plans for consideration on our state's redistricting system. The Senate and House held public outreach hearings this entire interim. The Senate had 6 hearings around the state, and the House had 14 hearings to receive public access. To receive public testimony about where people want like plans in their areas of the state. These were publicized and recorded and are used to gather information, and actually they're considered as part of the Section 5 voting rights preclearance record of participation in Texas. We have 4 websites, 2 primary ones. We have our main redistricting website, which provides information and news for the legislature and the public. A redistricting FTP site, which has data downloads, and District Viewer, which I'll show you in a minute. And then, so this is our main redistricting website for information. In the middle there, you see we have an announcements page and a news section on the side. We also have publications, and then we talk about the redistricting process, legal requirements, the redistricting history, and a current timeline. This site is very useful in terms of education for the public and for the legislatures. It's the same site There's not two separate sites for both groups. It's designed to provide easy distribution of materials and news. There's, like I said, the anticipated timeline and the legal requirements and the history of the last three redistricting cycles. Plus, we link to the committees, the Census Bureau, Department of Justice, redistricting voting rights section, and NCSL. So, announcements and news. There are dates for hearings. You can have deadlines for legislative or judicial body submissions of plans. Notice that a specific plan has been adopted. Notice about court filings of particular litigation and actions by state or federal agencies that directly affect redistricting in Texas, such as the availability of census data or preclearance decisions. We provide a timeline. This is particularly helpful for the members, but as Tim was saying, this is a very short time frame in Texas for the House and Senate to actually work on House and Senate plans. So that's they have to be finished this year by May 30th. If they aren't, then it goes to a legislative redistricting board for House and Senate, and the special session could be called on congressional, or it could just go to court. The process is described on this website. Again, this is information for the public. We try to teach people. There's, you know, not everyone knows what redistricting is, and so in addition to the public hearings that I just referred to, there's the bill process, the commission process, if it goes to that, the Voting Rights Act submission, judicial review. It seems like we always go to court in Texas. And then there are elections under the new districts. Again, as Tim referred to, you have to notify the counties about where the district lines are and give them time to redraw their precincts. There's a large legal section that includes federal and state specific requirements, glossary. We have publications, too, the population change in Texas since 2000. This was put out early last year to give people an idea that change is coming. Probably at least half the legislators in Texas have not been through this process before, and it was to give them and the public an idea that even though maybe your district has grown at the same rate as the rest of the state has grown and you think you're good, you know, if they need population from West or East Texas to fill in their districts where the growth has not been as fast, your district will be changing also. The guide to 2011 redistricting basically covers what's on the website in one easy printout. The data for redistricting, we'll talk about the census data, the election data that we collect, and then there's a large publication on state and federal law governing redistricting in Texas, not quite as big as Tim's book, but almost. Additional information we provide about current districts. There's maps and population election reports that can be downloaded and printed. And then the historical process, which covers the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. And it provides an indication of how much this process varies every decade. It's never the same. So just to give people an idea that we don't really know how it will go. Another thing that this site links to is our redistricting FTP site. And here you can download databases and shapefiles. These are free to the public, and gigabytes of this data are downloaded every month and have been for the last several years. We collect election returns, turnout, and registered voters by precinct for every election, primary runoff in general. And on the website, we have 2002 to 2010. We've been doing that since 1986, so we have older data also available. We have GIS shapefiles and block files for the current plans. We have census geography that we use, and then the precincts that correspond with the election returns. And then we also have ability to download data from the proposed plans that will be going through the process. The benefits of a website are great. They relieve staff from answering a lot of questions and save us a lot of time because people can actually access this data, learn about the process, and get that data. It's convenient for the public and for lawyers, media, and interested parties. The data is available 24/7, so if you're working late at night, you can get it. You don't have to wait for us to be there. You can also print things locally as soon as they're posted. Last time around, we had to print everything, and you had to come to our offices to purchase the maps and reports as plans were processed. But this time, they'll be available right away. One of our premier applications is District Viewer, and I'm going to demonstrate this quickly in a second, but it's an interactive plan viewing system that's used to look at and compare current districts with proposed districts that have been made public through the redistricting process. And it's available to legislature and the public, and it features overlaying, comparing two plans, so you can look at your current plan and then any proposed amendment. You can find an address, city or county, and you can access, again, those things 24/7. So this is what it looks like. You select a base plan. So here's a current Senate plan. And then you can select an overlay plan. So there's one that I hope that shows up, but it's got the Senate plan with the current congressional districts because I don't have any amendments yet. We don't have the data. But you can then zoom in just like with Google Maps and get data. Here's one showing cities with plans. You can also turn on precincts, so you can select where you are with that. You can find an address. You can find your own address or a legislator's address and zoom in and look at both plans and see which plan you'd be in. Again, this is going to be current. As plans are made public through the redistricting process, and I use that in a different term of public participation, but as a plan is passed, you know, considered by the legislature and committee, they will be posted, and you can get those. And as of last week, we now have an application, an iPhone app. So if you have iPhone, you can actually get it right away. The site also links to who represents me from that address, which tells you which members and districts represent you, and links to their web pages. You can also download a shapefile or a statewide map. So those proposed plans you can link to. If you have another application, you can download that geographic file and look at it and download population and election reports. These are the same reports that the members get when bills are passed, being considered that they get. And final feature is the district drawing application that we have in Texas. It's available to the members in their capital and district offices, but it's also available to the public by appointment in council offices in Austin. Training is provided, and then people make appointments and come in and use that and can then submit plans to the committees. Plans drawn on the application can be imported and exported in standard formats to other applications. And I was asked to cover a little bit about other states. Florida is developing a free public web-based application. Minnesota has a very informative website. I looked around. A lot of states don't have their websites up yet. Some vendors have web applications for sale. And I wanted to say that I think one of the reasons that we have our web application and website up right now is that a lot of states don't have a single nonpartisan support agency like we do in Texas. In some, the House and Senate have separate support, and in others, the Democrats and Republicans have separate support. Sometimes I think they have four different people, groups supporting them, so they're sort of spread out. A number of states have a commission system. So, and in addition, we're a voting rights Section 5 state, so we need to have that election data by precinct. The states that don't have that may have different needs, and that concludes my prepared testimonies. So thank you.
Test, test, test.
Yours is working.
Okay. Yeah.
Listen, we only have a bit of time, so let's go immediately to the audience.
Those were really useful overviews and entertaining as well. So there was a question in the back initially?
There was. Right? I don't know if she still has it or not, but. Oh, good. Claire answered.
We took
care
of it. I
moved to adjourn then.
All righty. Yes, sir.
I just have a question, man.
We're going to bring a mic to you.
I'll try mic.
Okay, we'll share this one.
Yeah, we're fine. We can share these.
Go ahead.
Hi. I mean, ostensibly, I guess the goal is to avoid gerrymandering in this process, but what standards should be used to determine whether a district is gerrymandered? Is it compactness? Is that the most important criteria? Or what other, say, standards can you use to measure whether a district is gerrymandered?
Let me say a word, and then I'm going to let Tim really roll.
I'll try.
Typically, when we talk about gerrymandering, we talk about racial gerrymandering. We talk about partisan gerrymandering, and we talk about incumbent gerrymandering. So one of it has to do with whether there is a line-drawing process that disadvantages racial minorities, and we have a body of law that governs that process. The second really goes to the issue of partisan fairness, and there are various sort of measures that one can construct that say if there is a swing in the vote in a particular state, a partisan swing, does the swing in districts roughly reflect that sentiment, or is it symmetrical between the two parties with a swing going, say, Republican direction and then Democratic direction? Do you get sort of roughly equal symmetrical results, or is the system rigged to produce, say, a Democratic advantage, whatever the nature of the vote swing is? And then finally, competitiveness of districts. The compactness, the contiguity, the communities of interest really go to a set of other interests and usually are embedded in state law.
Well, I guess also, is compactness generally a good way to avoid the bad outcomes that you all are talking about?
Not necessarily. It seems like such an innocent question, but it's also, very, 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 it's a clever question. I don't think you're trying to be clever, but it's a difficult question to answer. And I'm also fully aware there are people in this room who probably would be more qualified to answer this than I, so I hope they will jump in when I go astray. But the notion of how do you define a gerrymander? What are the standards for defining an egregious partisan gerrymander, or gerrymander, as some people like to say? To honor the actual pronunciation of the original Elbridge Gerry. The fact is that under the law, there are no standards for partisan gerrymandering. In fact, that's not true. There is one standard now that the court established, the federal courts endorsed by the U.S. Supreme Court, established in this round of redistricting, this past round of redistricting. So going into this cycle of redistricting, there is actually, for the first time, I think, a limit on partisan gerrymandering. And I'll explain that briefly in just a second, to the best of my knowledge. But the courts have grappled with this extensively, and in fact, if you read the minority opinion in a case called Veith versus Jubilee from 2003, you will see a pretty articulate version of what you could have as standards to define a partisan gerrymander. But Justice Kennedy, who was the swing vote in that case, sided with the majority in saying that the state of Pennsylvania in their congressional redistricting plan had not violated Article 1 of the Constitution or 14th Amendment of the Constitution. They had not violated it because essentially Justice Kennedy, I think, came to the conclusion he couldn't come up with a standard. How do you define what is a partisan gerrymander? So under the law, there is no standard. And I think people are struggling with this very notion of, if we think it's bad, well, then you have to define it in some way that can be enforced. An enforceable mechanism for the courts to say legislature, or for the legislators to understand going in that they've gone too far, they've crossed the line in a partisan gerrymandering way. So partisan gerrymandering has been litigated extensively. I think going back to Gamillion versus Lightfoot in the 1960s, Bandemer, Badham versus You, and then Veith versus Jubilee was the big 2000 case, where again we made it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, which ruled 5-4. That partisan gerrymandering is not, as of today, technically unconstitutional. Although, again, Justice Kennedy sort of left the door cracked just a little bit, I think, that if there were a standard, he might consider reviewing that. Okay, so now I did say there is one limit. There was one definition. As states have to – the reason we do this is because the Constitution requires that districts be essentially even in population for legislative districts, be they city council, state legislature, or – U.S. House. Of course, the Senate is explicitly not. But the so every 10 years, when this new census data comes out, all the current districts essentially become unconstitutional because they don't satisfy the one person, one vote principle of the Constitution. So that's why we have to do redistricting every 10 years. In the 2000 round of redistricting, the Georgia legislature, at the time controlled by Democrats, drew a plan where they essentially overpopulated the Republican districts at about plus 5%, and they underpopulated the Democratic districts at not entirely throughout the plan, but in many of the districts at minus 5%. So they used their sort of deviation from the perfect district size to essentially sort of pack Republicans and not pack Democrats because they were trying to spread their Democratic base into their districts, right? Now, the a district court in a case called Larios versus Cox said that you can't push the population boundaries if your only reason is partisan gain. So now we know there's at least one limit on sort of partisan push in plans, which is that you can't overpopulate one party's districts and underpopulate another party's districts because that would run afoul of the you have to have a rational reason for going beyond one person, one vote, a perfect ideal of one person, one vote. So the answer to your question is that there are no standards and that there are many proposals for standards, the best of which have been articulated, I think, in some of the filings in Veith, if you go back to the 2003 litigation in Veith. But under the law, there are no definitions. So.
But then, Tim, thank you. But there's the explicit question is, if your sole MO is to create compact districts, will that help or hurt the process? That's really what, in part, he was asking.
I mean, probably nobody's sole MO is to create compact districts.
Right.
Because you're trying to balance, you know, many factors in drawing these plans. And only one state had an explicit criteria for competitiveness, right? And that was Arizona, where Michael worked and some other folks worked. And the problem was, again, they didn't rank the criteria, by the way, in Arizona. And I think that's one of the issues when you're struggling with reform and criteria-driven reform and how to manage the politics. I mean, anytime you start talking about egregious redistricting, people will inevitably say you can't take redistricting out of, or you can't take politics out of redistricting, which I think is very true. I mean, it's sort of a simple cliche way to say it, but it's completely intertwined, right? I mean, no matter who draws the plan, the outcome will have tremendous political impact, and there will be Republican districts and there will be Democratic districts at the end of the day, no matter who draws the plan. So the question is, how do you manage the politics? What's the best forum to manage the politics? Is it an elected body? Is it an appointed body? Who appoints them? You know, what are the side effects? Compactness is one way, and sort of criteria-driven reform, I think, is one of the most probably interesting paths to look at this with contiguity. Contiguity is pretty easy. I mean, no states
got a highway,
run afoul of that. I mean, they're... People have played with it, but for the most part. Communities of interest, which, again, there'll be more defining of that, which is why a rigorous public hearing schedule to sort of flesh out what are the communities of interest, I think, is really important in the process, and that's what most states are doing. So,
do you want to say Michael will no doubt talk about this. He's done some work as well on the impact, the differential impact of compactness requirements across states, depending on how the population is distributed. It's really, it's not a panacea.
That's right. And that's the other problem. There's five ways to define compactness, of which Tom will now inform us. What are the five ways to do compactness?
No, you might also want to read the Texas decision. There's some discussion on that topic, but a lot of people would say, are the districts responsive, as you brought up? Yep. For instance, in Pennsylvania, some would claim that was a gerrymander, but actually by responsiveness standards, it wasn't.
That's a good point.
Some may claim that Texas was a gerrymander, but by responsiveness, it wasn't the gerrymander. The gerrymander was the previous plan. And incidentally, the Texas plan was not drawn by Tom DeLay. That's a myth. It's drawn by the legislators. You also have a situation where, for their benefit, I mean, they wanted the new districts. But, for instance, I think Jerry would verify that the Democrats thought that Michigan was a gerrymander.
Probably, yeah.
Yet those districts were very compact and followed all the rules in the state. So it's often in the eye of the beholder. But responsiveness and weird shapes are kind of the index, but I think you have to have both.
Thank you, Tom.
And incidentally, you got your scorecard wrong. It's 194 districts to 44.
I didn't put it up there. I think I said it vaguely, but yeah, you're right. I said like 150.
We have
right,
a mic like all the way in the back, right behind you.
Do we have a definition of responsiveness? Like, what do we mean by responsiveness?
Oh, in this case, what Tom was talking about and referring to what I said, it's a measure of partisan fairness so that you sort of analyze some underlying partisan vote in the state and then look and use that in the districts and look to see if you had a uniform swing sort of nationally across whether it would have similar effects if it were a Republican or a Democratic swing. There are various standards that have been used. New Jersey has used a measure of this. My old professor Donald Stokes created one of the sort of first methodological approaches to measuring it.
Who chaired the redistricting commission exactly. In New Jersey?
Yes. Right here.
Hi, this would be for Ms. Dyer particularly, but any of you can answer it. What measures have been taken since that aberration in 2003 in Texas to guarantee that it would never happen again in Texas or any other state where a state would just willy-nilly decide to have a redistricting out of time?
A redistricting.
Do you want to?
I think maybe Tim can. I don't think there's been anything specifically done towards that.
I mean, that very question was litigated all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court said that there is no legal limit, that if your state constitution doesn't prohibit you from redrawing lines more than once a decade, then you can do it more than once a decade. So the answer is it's in some states, not all states. And I don't know the number. Do you know the number? They like 20 states or so. Yeah, I mean, there are a number of states where the state constitution very clearly says you can only do it once a decade. Now, I will say, it is the negative publicity that these folks took in Texas, I think, was a pretty strong cautionary tale. Legislators are not eager to do redistricting over and over and over again in the decade. I mean, it happened, in Colorado and maybe Georgia? New Hampshire, but I still think that, and there are always, by the way, are technical corrections in the middle of the decade that take place in many states, but I don't think there's an appetite for mid-decade redistricting, certainly not among my constituents, my folks. So I think it's going to be by far the dramatic exception to the rule, and the stars have to align politically just right for it to happen, and they have to sort of weigh, are we willing to take the grief and the mocking and the negative PR And Tom Dooley did not draw the plan in Texas. That's absolutely true. He didn't draw the plan. I mean, was he involved in sort of engineering the partisan takeover of the Texas House? Yes. And now, of course, that's what, you know, the prosecutor has alleged. And he's been convicted of at the trial court level before appeal. So
fair and balanced.
Yeah. I'm trying. I'm nonpartisan, right? Let's keep that in mind.
Okay, we actually need to move on to our next session. So, Michael, would you come up and lead us to the next? Please join me in thanking our colleagues here.
Thanks a lot, Tom.